ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Prime Ministers of Australia and Papua New Guinea are hiking the famous Kokoda Track. How will their journey affect the relationship between our two countries? Also, the Victorian Premier rejects calls for a second supervised drug injecting room in Melbourne. And an Australian graduates from the European Astronaut Program. Will she make it into space?
Not every astronaut actually does get into space. You know, there are particular missions with particular skill sets that are needed. But the thing is, now she'll be in the running. And she is an Australian astronaut.
First this evening, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and his Papua New Guinean counterpart, James Marape, have set off together on a two-day hike of the historic Kokoda Track. The 1942 Battle of Kokoda was arguably Australia's most significant campaign of World War II, with Australian troops doggedly fighting for 4 months to stop the Japanese reaching Port Moresby and moving on to Australia. The leaders' trek will culminate in an Anzac Day dawn service on Thursday, honouring the hundreds of Australians killed in PNG more than 80 years ago. This report from Rachel Hayter.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese disembarks his helicopter at the fabled Kokoda village and spots his PNG counterpart and trekking partner, Papua New Guinean Prime Minister James Marape.
Ah!
My brother.
Welcome. Oro.
Mr. Albanese is given a chief's welcome. Locals dance a sing-sing ceremony and deck him in traditional woven clothing and headdress. Children wearing the national colours of Australia and PNG sing.
Just gifts of beauty, rich and rare.
Before the historic trek begins.
I grew up in contact with almost over 20 different cultures. My parents were missionaries moving from one place to another.
Yeah. Seventh-day Adventists.
Right.
It's just wonderful. It's such a humbling experience to walk in the footsteps of giants with the PNG Prime Minister. We're walking step by step, symbolising our two nations. Walking together.
Mr. Albanese and Mr. Marape will spend the next 2 days walking part of the Kokoda Track in temperatures over 30 degrees and with oppressive humidity ahead of Anzac Day commemorations on Thursday. Mr. Marape told a state dinner in Port Moresby last night he has a special role to play.
The next possibly 30 hours of our journey together in the mountains, or 36 hours, I choose to be your number one security guard. Your number one security guard. In every sense of the word.
Also expected to walk is Gary Jaffa, governor of PNG's Oro province.
It's an opportunity for us to present our thoughts to them and express to them our concerns that for far too long we feel that the trail and indeed the station has not received the attention it deserves in terms of resources. We understand that both governments, especially the Australian government, have been putting funds into this, but we would like a lot more attention so that we can do a great job of maintaining the station, maintaining the trail, and continuing to respect those who served in World War II.
He also wants to discuss other subjects, including local road infrastructure and climate change. Kokoda was one of Australia's most significant campaigns of the Second World War, with the Japanese getting closer to Australia than in any other battle. Approximately 625 Australians were killed and more than 1,600 were wounded. Fighting alongside Australian soldiers, the Papua New Guineans who became known as the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels.
So they were used as scouts as well as labourers, and they carried the wounded back to the bottom of the track to the doctors as well during the campaign.
Oliver Nobito is the FDC Pacific Fellow with the Lowy Institute. He believes there's a deep understanding of Australia in Papua New Guinea, but PNG is little understood here.
The Australian and Papua New Guinean relationship is one that is not necessarily transactional. I think it's one that is formed out of goodwill. Both are able to learn from each other, as well as for Papua New Guinea in particular. I think with Australia's colonial administration, it still remains the largest partner in terms of development. And for a lot of the progress that happens, especially in terms of the governance sector, there is, you know, a fair bit of guidance that Australia plays a role in this.
Tess Newton-Kane is the project lead for the Pacific Hub at Griffith Asia Institute. She agrees it's goodwill that counts in this relationship.
Too much focus on the securitisation and the security aspect will actually prove a strategic hurdle. It's strategically inept, because the way for Australia to secure itself and to be secure in its region is to be a part of the region and to be building those relationships on the basis of why they're important in themselves, not simply as some kind of transactional security deal.
China's been making big investments in PNG, and on a visit just in the last week, the Chinese foreign minister argued Pacific Island countries are not the backyard of any major country.
Australia's economy has grown on the back of its relationship with China. So from the Papua New Guinean side, it would seem a bit odd and possibly hypocritical for Australia to say, oh, but you can't do that. We did that, but we don't want you doing that. So the tone of the conversation and the messaging needs to be much more nuanced and sophisticated.
And Tess Newton-Kane has some ideas about how the Australia-PNG relationship can be developed beyond the symbolism and shared history and suffering of Kokoda.
I'm sure there are plenty of Papua New Guinean families that would love for Mr. Albanese to announce that Papua New Guineans can study in Australia and pay domestic student fees instead of international student fees.
She says PNG's relatively small tourism sector would love to see more Australians holidaying there.
Papua New Guinea has an awful lot to offer tourists, particularly tourists that are looking for that kind of adventure tourism, you know, trekking, diving, whitewater rafting, canoeing, all of those things. So there's definitely scope for that, and there are certainly parts of Papua New Guinea that are looking to the tourism sector of how they can diversify the economy and build the economy.
Anthony Albanese is the first sitting Australian Prime Minister to do the Kokoda track. His efforts will culminate in an Anzac Day dawn service on Thursday, expected to be attended by about 400 people.
Rachel Hayter reporting. The battle between Australian authorities and the social media platform X is continuing, and experts say it could reshape what we look at online. The federal government's e-safety commissioner has won a temporary emergency injunction forcing Elon Musk's X to block access to videos of last week's Sydney church terrorist attack. Free speech advocates argue it's the wrong move, but others say Australia has an opportunity to set a safer course for social media use. Stephanie Smale reports.
The fight over the content that flows through social media isn't new, and it's far from over. After Elon Musk's reluctance to remove videos of the attack in a Sydney church, the eSafety Commissioner took the issue to court and won temporarily. But not everyone supports the Commissioner Julie Inman Grant's efforts to force the removal of the video. Reuben Kirkham from the Free Speech Union of Australia argues she's overstepping.
Is it reasonable for all that content, any footage whatsoever by the sounds of it, of a particular public event, given the implied freedom of political communication, to be taken off the internet? It looks like we're censoring in a way that a despotic country would do. And we do not believe they have the legal power to do what they've done. The test for X is reasonable steps. Is it reasonable to ask X to take it off the entire internet, not just for Australia?
The Safety Commissioner has been granted a 2-day legal injunction to compel X to hide posts that include graphic footage relating to the church stabbing. X has been ordered to hide the material from all users worldwide until Wednesday at 5 p.m, when the matter will be considered again in more detail. Reuben Kirkham argues the last-minute timing of the court action late yesterday wasn't fair on X. He's also concerned that the exact details of what's been restricted haven't been made public.
The content is not, you know, at a level of extremity that a Section 109 notice would warrant. There are other notices they could have applied
someone
for,
is
but
being
they didn't.
Stabbed. Someone is being stabbed in these videos. Why should that be online?
Well, the eSafety Commissioner has not published the notice, even though they should have done. So we don't know exactly what their arguments are, and that is our concern. Unfortunately, yes, there are horrible things that happen to people. We don't help by hiding them.
So as the ideological battle over free speech versus responsible publishing continues, what real steps can Australian authorities take to control graphic content on social media? Dr. Dana Mackay is the Associate Dean of Interaction, Technology and Information at RMIT University. She says there are practical moves possible, such as asking search engine companies to delist social media platforms that don't follow the rules.
Search engine companies are paying attention to where their customers are. So if they notice you're in Australia, they could, for example, be required by law to delist X or face legal penalty themselves. But in the most serious cases, the eSafety Commission can require internet providers to block access to certain sites or services.
X has already been threatened with hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines if it doesn't cooperate. Dr. Mackay thinks that's likely.
To some extent, everyone's testing these laws, right? Both the eSafety Commission, the government, Elon Musk and X. Everyone's kind of going, okay, so is anyone going to back down here? So I think at the very least, we will see a fine issued.
She says this particular debate could play an important role in how social media is managed in Australia in the future.
There are some people who speak very loudly who are complaining of censorship and it's my right to see whatever I want on social media. But I think there are a lot of people who maybe don't usually speak so loudly who are like, actually, you know what? I don't need to see someone getting stabbed on social media. Thanks anyway. Facebook, for example, allows people who are like 14 to use the platform. And we don't want 14-year-olds seeing stabbings while they're scrolling through their feeds.
Do you think this is a turning point in Australia's relationship with social media?
Look, I think we are slowly turning a corner. So the first turning point was actually when we said, right, you have to pay our news providers. And social media went, wait, no, we don't. I think Australia is providing some very leading steps towards saying that social media companies, if they want to operate in Australia, have to be good social actors. And I think it will be interesting to see how this plays out.
A spokesperson for the eSafety Commissioner says companies like Google, Microsoft, Snap and TikTok have been working with the office to remove the graphic material. X will have the opportunity to argue against the injunction request on Wednesday before a final decision is made.
Stephanie Smale reporting, and the Assistant Treasurer, Stephen Jones, says the government is determined to fight to keep platforms like X safe for users.
It's Australian users of social media and the Australian public that we're adamant must be kept safe. Democratic countries are rightly concerned about the material that's been broadcast on social media networks. And I just want to make this point. Freedom of speech is not unlimited in this country or anywhere else. It has always been limited by the responsibilities that come with that. And in many instances, those responsibilities are enshrined in law.
The Assistant Treasurer, Stephen Jones. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, an Australian graduates from the European Astronaut Program. Will she make it into space? The The Victorian government has abandoned a long-held promise to set up a second supervised drug injecting room in Melbourne's CBD. The decision goes against an expert report advising that injecting rooms save lives and that a small facility should be opened in the city centre. Instead, the government has announced a $95 million statewide action plan to tackle drug overdoses. Nell Whitehead has more.
The Victorian government pledged in 2020 to open a second supervised injecting room in Melbourne, following the success of its first such facility in North Richmond. After years of delays, Premier Jacinta Allen has abandoned those plans, saying her government couldn't find an appropriate location in the city's CBD.
We were clear in looking at different sites across the CBD that the location needed to balance the needs of people who use drugs with the needs of the broader CBD community. We have been unable to find a location that strikes the right balance, and that is why a second injecting service in the CBD is not our plan and it won't be proceeding.
By abandoning the promise, her government has rejected the advice of an expert report led by the former Victorian Police Commissioner Ken Lay. The state government belatedly released that report today, a year after it received it. It recommended opening a small and discreet injecting room in Melbourne's CBD to tackle a surge of heroin use in the area. It cited strong evidence that injecting services save lives. Paul McDonald is CEO of Anglicare Victoria, one of dozens of charities and health organisations that had advocated for another facility.
The government had long held plans to open a second facility because the evidence was so strong from the Richmond facility that had opened in 2018. 63 deaths avoided, 7,000 overdoses, of which none were fatality. I mean, that is unheard of. These are not only life-saving, but life-changing models. And, you know, this is a despairing decision for drug users.
Instead, the government announced a $95 million plan to tackle drug overdoses. That includes $36 million to establish a new CBD community health hub, which will offer a trial of hydromorphone, a drug used to wean people off heroin. Dr. Paul McCartney is an addiction specialist with community health provider CoHealth. He says he has mixed feelings about the government's plan.
There's evidence that injecting rooms save lives. We'll continue to advocate, because we're advocating for evidence-based solutions, continue to advocate that supervised injecting room be part of the suite of treatments available in Victoria.
But plans for an injecting room in the CBD had met with stiff resistance from residents and businesses. Mark O'Reilly owns Melbourne's Elephant and Wheelbarrow Hotel and is vice president of the Australian Hotels Association Victoria.
It would be shocking for not only for my business, but for all the retail shops, restaurants and theatre nearby. You know, we've had a tough couple of years and we're just coming back to ourselves now, and having this would be just detrimental to the whole area and precinct. We welcome the government's decision. I think it's the right decision to make.
So does that explain the government's change of heart? Paul Strangio is Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash University. He argues the decision sets the tone for a less socially progressive Victorian government under Jacinta Allen.
Well, I think it's arguably the first defining decision of Jacinta Allen's premiership. And what it seems to signal is a caution and possibly a retreat from the way Daniel Andrews, her predecessor, used to like to characterise and position his government as the most progressive government in the nation. This decision not to go ahead with a second safety injecting facility seems to signal a movement away from the Labor's progressive credentials here in Victoria.
Does it signal a kind of lack of courage then relative to Daniel Andrews, do you think?
I think it can be definitely interpreted as a signal about the temper of Jacinta Allen's leadership. I think also, look, it's disappointing in the sense that governments always protest they make evidence-based decisions, and here you have the great bulk of evidence, informed opinion, saying that safe injecting rooms are the way to protects some of the most vulnerable members of our community, and yet the government has decided not to proceed down that path. It is disappointing in that context.
Paul Strangio is an Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash University. That report from Nell Whitehead. If you're on the youth allowance because you're studying or looking for work, there's some bad news on the housing front today, and you probably won't be surprised. Anglicare's latest snapshot has found there are no affordable rental properties for people on the allowance anywhere in Australia. With young people so badly affected by the housing crisis, a Tasmanian organisation has an idea to help provide more housing in that state, but it says it'll need generous backers to make it happen. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Like many parts of Australia, Tasmania has a growing youth homelessness problem. About 39% of its homeless people are under the age of 25. Di Underwood is the chief executive of Tasmanian housing provider Colony 47.
Last census, there was 1,400 young people from the ages of, I think, ABS do 15 to 24, but we see kids as young as 10, 11 and 12 coming to see us with no adults and who are homeless. They were the fastest growing cohort in the presentations to specialist homeless services like Colony 47, and it had increased by about 42%.
So with young people overrepresented in the figures, what can be done about it? There's no simple answer. Young people often need extra support, so social housing isn't always a solution. Di Underwood is looking for a new approach. She's thinking about getting into the hotel business. There's a central hotel for sale in Hobart called Fountainside she has her eye on. It was purchased a few years ago by the University of Tasmania, but is no longer needed as student accommodation, so it's now on the market.
But Fountainside, just walking in there, it is perfect. You know, about 50 rooms. Every floor's got 7 rooms. They're all self-contained, quite big. You could provide a lot of support for young people while they're there, which would really help them with all those independent living skills. I think the beauty of Fountainside is also that it's close to TAFE. It's close to uni.
But getting hold of the property might not be easy. The university paid $18 million for it 6 years ago. An expression of interest process to purchase the site is now underway. Colony 47 needs to get backers with deep pockets on board to make it happen.
What we're thinking at the moment is putting together investment proposals so that I can go to philanthropic foundations. What we understand, these philanthropic foundations, and they're interested in Tassie because whilst this is a shameful problem and we're seeing it getting bigger, on an Australian scale, about 1,000 young homeless people is tiny. And it's solvable. We can fix this.
Di Underwood hopes it could be a valuable experiment for the entire country.
We know with a service model we're putting together that it would be really an innovative service model that people on the mainland would look at and go, actually, this could be the way we could solve regional youth housing crisis.
New figures demonstrate how severe that crisis is. A report from Anglicare finds that if you're on youth allowance, there's not a single home anywhere in the country you could afford to rent, not even a room in a share house. Mary Bennett is the coordinator for Anglicare's Social Action and Research Centre in Tasmania. She says the roughly 134,000 people who rely on income support payments in the state are struggling to find homes to live in.
What we're seeing is that there's nothing that's affordable for single people on the age pension, job seeker, disability support pension, youth allowance. Basically, if they'd have opened the paper at the end of March and looked for a property in the private market, they wouldn't have found one.
It means more and more young people are living in insecure housing.
We're seeing more and more people who are temporarily staying with friends, couch surfing. We're seeing people overcrowding in houses, and a lot of people just living in temporary or improvised accommodation like tents, caravans, sleeping in their car, and of course people in shelters.
Tanya Hunt is the chief executive of the Youth Network of Tasmania. She argues once young people fall through the cracks, it's very difficult for them to get back into housing.
Certainly what we have at the moment is a very fragmented service system. We have many young people who do not have a pathway out of homelessness. So we need to see greater investment in the youth homelessness services system so that all young people have the opportunity to have a roof over their head.
She's open to the idea of using hotels to solve the youth housing crisis.
I think we need to consider the model. It certainly does have its merits, but we would need to actually obviously consider what the advantages and perhaps disadvantages might be of accommodation of that nature. But certainly I think we should be considering all options.
Tanya Hunt from the Youth Network of Tasmania, Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Well, not many Australians have made it into space, but there are hopes another will get there soon. Catherine Bennell-Pegg has graduated from the European Space Agency's astronaut program. It doesn't guarantee she'll get a shot at travelling beyond Earth's atmosphere, but it does mean she's part of an elite group ready to be called on when the right mission comes along. And it's hoped her success will generate enthusiasm for space studies in Australia. PM's David Sparks spoke to Associate Professor Alice Gorman, a space industry expert at Flinders University.
It is exciting. It is a big deal. There's only been three ever Australian astronauts before. And, of course, now we have a woman who's going to space, and women are pretty underrepresented in space to begin with. But in human spaceflight, Australians in general are very underrepresented. So it is exciting that we're going to have someone who has that experience.
Yeah, her name is Catherine Bennell-Pegg. Do you know anything about her?
Well, she has in fact worked for the Australian Space Agency. So she's got a very good knowledge of Australia's space program and Australia's ambitions in space. So it's, you know, really fitting that she gets to add this extra dimension to her experience and knowledge of space as well.
Do you think she'll get to go into space? Because it's not certain, is it?
No. So people can be trained as astronauts and their career is an astronaut. They're a professional astronaut, but not every astronaut actually does get into space. So a whole bunch of reasons for that. You know, there are particular missions with particular skill sets that are needed. Sometimes people just aren't available. They try to sort of roster missions around people to make sure everybody gets a go. But a lot of astronauts have only ever been to space once. I mean, but that's kind of all you need. But the thing is now she'll be in the running for future missions. And she is an Australian astronaut.
What do you think it takes to be a good astronaut, cosmonaut, Australianaut, whatever we're calling it? Because I know the semantics are a bit picky on this one.
Well, traditionally, astronauts have been drawn from quite a narrow range of people who've tended to have military and engineering backgrounds. But in recent years, that's been opened up a lot more. So the big space agencies are acknowledging that you don't have to be an engineer to do a really good job in space. It's about a lot of other things as well. A key thing is getting on with people, particularly if you're cooped up in the spacecraft with them or living for a year in a space station with you know, five people for the entire year. So those social skills are also increasingly being considered. But if you're relying on someone to make a good decision in case of equipment failure, for example, or some kind of emergency, you do want someone whose training enables them to think fast and to respond according to that training. So that's what makes professional astronauts different to the growing group of space tourists that are going up there.
Mm. So let's take a step back and think about this in terms of the Australian space industry. Does it help? Is it a shot in the arm? Will it create perhaps enthusiasm?
Something Australians have always been enthusiastic about is human spaceflight. It really catches the Australian imagination. Anytime astronauts come to visit, people are so excited to see them, take selfies with them, have all of the questions about, you know, the classic question is, how do you go to the toilet in space? People in Australia are fascinated by, it is the most commonly asked question of any astronaut. So we love human spaceflight in Australia. It's definitely an inspirational piece. So the sort of thing that makes people think, oh, you know, maybe I could do that. However, in terms of our space industry, it's probably less important. So we have a much bigger focus on things like Earth observation, satellite development. And now we have a huge research program looking at plants that can be used for space habitation and long-term space flight. So while it's high profile and it really appeals to the public imagination, it's not something that's sort of straight down the line in our priorities in space industry. I mean, nobody's unhappy about this. It's exciting. But, you know, it's one small piece of a much, much bigger space industry that is doing a lot of different things.
That's Associate Professor Alice Gorman from Flinders Uni. She was speaking to David Sparks. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. If you'd like to listen back to any of our interviews and reports, you'll find them on the PM webpage. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Australian political leaders have united in their condemnation of Elon Musk. And Musk is ready for a legal fight over the removal of videos and images of last week's Sydney church stabbing from his social media platform X, formerly Twitter. Today, host of Tech Podcast, Download This Show, Mark Fennell, on whether Musk can really be controlled. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.